accession number 20274, Reel 2.
Ron Newbold, Reel 2.
Yeah, the headquarter company had a guardsman who was the battalion butcher. He was also a slaughterer by trade as well. So we were going around collecting cattle and slaughtering them to give the cooks in the companies fresh meat. And this was part of the job of getting it up to the front line wherever possible, so the cooks could prepare food for the chaps fighting.
What was morale like with the battalion in the Louvain area?
It was very good, actually. There was only one problem, that we'd marched from Louvain, and I don't know how many kilometres it was, but the chaps were suffering with blisters on their feet and that kind of thing, making walking very hard. And I myself left the battalion at Louvain because I went somewhere along the line, I got some foreign bodies in my eyes, and it was very painful. And I went forward to meet the medical officer, battalion medical officer, and he said to me, "How's your feet?" And I said, "They're fine, sir. It's my eyes. I can't see very well." He said, "Well, I haven't got time to look at your eyes. I've got all these chaps' feet to look after." There was also a guardsman there that he'd done something to his hand and he got blood poisoning. And he said, "He can see where he's going, so he can lead you. And I want you to go back to the First Field Ambulance Station, which is a few miles down the road. And like every true story, you know, you leave here and you turn right and you turn left and that sort of thing. But by the time you've done the first two or three turns, you've lost your way. Wonder what else he said." So we asked a Belgian girl where the hospital was. This young lady kindly took us along to a big house, which was a nunnery, a hospital nunnery full of nuns and all old people. They wanted to take us in and look after our injuries. But we said, "No, we must find this army ambulance, field ambulance." And we came out and marching along the road again. Next thing, we're held up by a gendarme. And he said, "Halt." And he looks at the patch over my eyes and he said, knee blood. And then he looks at the guardsman and looks at the under his sling where he got his arm in a sling. And he said, "Knee blood," and he accused us of being saboteurs. He took our rifles off us because he was now banishing a big revolver in front of our noses. And he was promptly marching us off down the road. But fortunately, although I couldn't see, I managed to see the very small sign, First Field Ambulance, and I managed to persuade him to allow us to go into this field where the ambulance people were. And after a lot of palaver, he officially handed it over to the officer in charge of the ambulance section, and they wanted to kiss us on both cheeks. I'm afraid I used a little bit of army language, and the doctor was very much alarmed by this and said it wasn't the way to talk to people. I said, "Well, if you've been walking for the last half an hour with a revolver in your back, perhaps you would say the same words." From there, the medical officer said, "Well, what's your trouble?" And he said, "Well, no, I can't do anything for you now. We've just been ordered back to retire for 10 miles back. Jump in one of the ambulances and I'll attend to you as soon as I can." This 10 miles retreat went on for something like 2 days, I think. And we eventually found ourselves in a big base hospital just outside of Dunkirk, where there was a massive field with the most gigantic marquees I've ever seen. They were all full of stretchers. On every stretcher there was a body of every nationality serving in that theatre of the war, from English, French, Germans, Polish, all sorts of people with wounds. And when I arrived there, they said to me, "Go and find a stretcher in one of these marquees," he said, "and we'll see to you later on." And the marquee I picked was full of these people, and there was a stretcher there, which I claimed for myself. And then these poor soldiers laying there were saying, could you go and get me some water? Could you get me something to eat? So for about the next 4 days, all I ever did was go to the cookhouse, get the McConaughey stew or dixies of water and go around feeding these chaps. And then on one day, we was all the walking wounded were ordered to the front of the hospital camp, and they was told that we were going to be put on a hospital ship. Walking wounded would go first. The ambulance people would pick up the stretchers of everybody but Germans. We were going to leave all the Germans behind, but everybody else, so we're going to load onto the hospital ship. We went to the ship and we had to go right down into the basement. We actually was in the propeller shelf tunnel. That's where we got in the end. And I think it was nearly all day. They were loading up with the stretchers and other people. And I don't really know, because information was not coming down. We couldn't see much light. But I guess in the time, it must have been in the evening, we were going to sail. And just before we moved, there was a big bump. The boat seemed to go down and then come up again. And we was told later on that a German shell or bomb had landed on the bridge, blown it away, but we were going to proceed home on the auxiliary steering.
What ship was this?
I don't. It was the last hospital ship to leave the quay at Dunkirk. And after some considerable time, we all landed at a place called Littlehampton.
What was the voyage like back?
Very quiet after that. After this bomb or whatever it was on the bridge, we just settled back and, you know, apprehension, because we never knew what was going on really, until we docked at Littlehampton. But we just sort of laughed and joked quietly among ourselves and waited for the day.
Had you had treatment for your eye problem?
No, that's it. No, I'd received no treatment up to that time. Nothing.
What happened to you next?
Well, when we got to Littlehampton, there was a train in there, and which was going to be taken to the various hospitals in England. The only enlightening part there was in those days, or just before the war, there used to be a charity run by a lady called the Silver Lady, where she used to take soup and those sort of things out to the poor down and outs in London. And she was down there at Littlehampton, and she was there with all our staff, giving us cups of tea and sandwiches, which was very acceptable. Also a packet of 5 woodbines. And after a long time no smoking, these woodbines were marvellous. We got on the train and was taken to...
Woking, was it?
Yeah, we were taken to Woking, where the mental hospital there had given over part of the hospital for the wounded soldiers coming back from France. And it was there that I received my first treatment of my eye. I was in the hospital for about a month, I think.
What was wrong with your eye?
They'd got an older eye specialist in, because he was telling me he'd been retired many years, but he'd come back to help out, and he said that I'd got actually 5 ulcers on my left eye, on the top of my left eye, which had owing to the long time, it also affected the side of my right eye, the pain that spread across. But he said that could be cured. After about a month, he said that I was fit enough to go back. I'd lost the 25% sight in my left eye. They gave me a pair of glasses, and I was then posted back to the Holding Battalion, which was now in the Regent's Park Barracks in London.
But you've been with the 2nd Battalion?
Well, yes, but this was a Holding Battalion. I now left the 2nd Battalion. As I understand it later on, I found out why I'd never been sent back to the battalion, I don't know, but I did find out later when they'd all got back to England, they'd been sent to Scotland, where they'd been re-equipped. And after a few weeks, they were sent back out to the Middle East. I stayed in London in the Holding Battalion under the famous Regimental Sergeant Major Ronald Britton, and we were doing public duties from there, marching from Regent's Park to Buckingham Palace every other day.
Any memories about Ronald Britton?
Well, people said that he was not a very nice man, but I think perhaps because he had been sent out, he was a 1st Battalion man, he had been sent out there to, with the BF, but I think because of his size, he probably wasn't a very good soldier for fighting. This is only my thoughts anyhow, and he'd been returned, and he was now in charge of the town. I think he felt he should have been out there with his men. And I was the first soldier he'd met that had come back from the BF. And he took me under his wing a little bit, I think, and made sure that when I came back that I got new equipment and I was sort of looked after. And every time we was on guard, if he could get me off the guard and put somebody else in it, he would do so, because he said, you've done your bit. But I found him, apart from if he was a regimental sergeant major, and you had to respect him as such, but I found him a very fair man during my short time that I was with him.
Anything particular happened to you in London at this time?
Well, the only thing that I do remember, that during one of the times that I was on guard at Buckingham Palace and still being a Lance Corporal, the Corporal used to post the sentries, and on one of the afternoon, I think it was, or about midday, posting the sentries and walking across the front of the palace in the quadrangle there, was when they dropped a bomb on the side of the palace, which was used to be the police house, I believe. And I just continued on my way posting the sentries. But, everybody else was laying down, but we all kept marching. I do remember that, because the sentry said to me, we ought to be laying down, Corporal. I said, no, we're not, we keep marching. But that was really the only thing that I do remember about that. It was just normal public duties. Every day, every other day from Regent's Park.
Was much damage done to the palace?
No, it was only a very small explosion. It wasn't a great deal about it, because it was when I returned to the guard room and I reported it to the guard commander, he'd not heard the explosion, so it must have been a very small one. But we were near enough to be a little bit scared, I think. And then from those things, that the 4th Battalion was then formed, and I was sent with a lot of other NCOs and a few men from this holding battalion down to Elstree, Bournewood, where we were going to billet the men forming this new battalion, and it was our job as the advance party to go around finding the billets and making sure everything was okay for when the other men joined us.
Were you in any other bombing in London?
Not directly, no. We actually, at the time that I was in London, we was known as the Defence of London, which was during the Battle of Britain. When we were formed in this new 4th Battalion, we had to make sure that we could reach London in the shortest possible time, and we used to do forced route marches from Elstree to Hyde Park Corner and those places, and I think it was the marching time was just over an hour, I think, that we could actually be in the centre of London. This probably may seem strange nowadays, because everybody rides in trucks, but in those days our only transport was our feet. There was no trucks for us to walk or ride about in. We had to walk or march.
What job were you given with the 4th Battalion?
Well, I was reduced to the ranks there for supposedly marching the squad in an idle manner. But I was told by one of our drill sergeants that this was a little bit of a fix-up, because some of the officers in No. 1 Company, which I was now attached to, had been with me in the 2nd Battalion as officers, and they wanted somebody to run their company officers' mess. And this is that they couldn't have me as an NCO, but they could have me as a guardsman. So I was reduced to the ranks and told that I was now in charge of the company, number one company officer's mess, where the job was to do the shopping and do their cooking. This continued for some time until the battalion moved to somewhere in Somerset, Frome. We went to Frome, where we were now employed as lorried infantry to the Guards Armoured Division. Lorried infantry, or sectionised infantry, was actually a section of about seven men in a 1500 weight truck, and there was each section had a truck plus all the headquarters, so it was rather a great number of vehicles. I say we were infantry of the Guards Armoured Division, but on one of the exercises that they held on Salisbury Plain, they found with the tanks and the infantry, there were so many vehicles that it was blocking the roads and causing chaos. And it was decided that the idea of infantry in 1500 weight trucks was not a good thing. So we were taken away from the Guards Armoured Division. And they said that they would find their own infantry if they wanted them. And it was just the Guards Armoured Division then just became a tank brigade or division. After some time, which rumours were flying about that we were going to be put in gliders, we were going to be airborne, the Guards Airborne Division, and all sorts of things like that, we suddenly found ourselves moved to a village just outside of Frome, where we were told that they were going to form another tank brigade of guardsmen, which was to be the ourselves, the Coldstreams, the Grenadiers and the Scots Guards. And we're all going to be issued with Churchill tanks. So from infantry, everybody had to go on training exercises to learn their various jobs, from radio operator to gun layer or mechanic, because my job in civilian life had been put on my papers as a storekeeper in the warehouse, that I was given the job as a sergeant storekeeper to headquarters squadron. So I went to Chilwell, where I had to learn all about all the parts that go into a tank, all the parts that go into our soft vehicles, our 1300 weight trucks and all those sort of things, which are Austin, our BSA motorcycles. And each company, or each squadron now, carried a technical stores lorry, which was the spare parts for all the vehicles that was in each squadron. So it was quite an experience, changing from one thing to another. But again, I was not in the front as a fighting soldier. Don't know whether luck was on my side or not. Sometimes I really felt out of it. I would have liked to have done more, perhaps. But on the occasion when the battalion changed from infantry to tanks, I did go to see the commanding officer and said that I would like to be a tank driver or a gunner or something like that, something more action. And he said, "You've been chosen because that's your trade, to be a storekeeper, so go back and get on with it." from training in just outside Frome, we then went up to a place called Bellaby Moor in Yorkshire, where all the tanks were doing their tank training. They were still being sent away on courses, some of the chaps, to learn gunnery and various things, but we were getting more competent with the tanks and the storekeeping and everything else that goes along with an armoured brigade. After a time, we went down to Nottingham, a place called Rufford Abbey, where again we were doing training in and around the forest. Then, just before D-Day, we were sent down, or just a considerable time before D-Day, we were sent down to Charing in Kent, where we carried on with our training. But on the actual arrangements for the landing in Normandy, we found we were held in reserve. The Guards Armoured Division had gone out in front, but we were now called the 6th Guards Independent Tank Brigade. We were held in reserve, and also we were told to go out in training, not to camouflage ourselves, but to let any enemy information from spies or photographing, let be seen, to try and fool the Germans that this invasion was only a practice, it wasn't a full-scale thing. And by seeing us carry on with our training, hope that we might deceive them. Then again, in after the invasion had gone over, we were brought forward from reserve and was in the New Forest there waiting to go onto the boats. Unfortunately, a German doodlebug had landed on our brigade workshops, which was the REME, the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers, which was actually on Charing Common. This doodlebug landed on the mechanics' Nissen huts, killing 46 men, no NCOs, just the mechanics, because there was only mechanics in these two huts. The commanding officer in charge of the workshops was then given a month in which to find these 46 men and replace them so that we could go out, because the war office and that said we weren't a competent fighting brigade because we didn't have a workshop. So we were now taken off the reserve and put back into reserve again until we had a full workshops.
Where were you when the V1 hit?
We were in the forest, in the New Forest, which is not very far away, but Charing is more or less on the edge of the New Forest there in Kent. But we were just...
So Kent is a long way from the New Forest.
Well, that's... No, yes, yeah, well, no, wait a minute. Have I got the story wrong then? My mind's gone. But it was on Charing Common this happened, and we... Perhaps the workshops had not been mobilised to go into the New Forest to join us. They may have... See, they may have well have been sending the fighting vehicles out first, and the workshops would have followed on. That's why they were not actually with us in the forest. And it was just that they got caught there in the open ground, I think. It's just one of those things. RAF was actually getting the wings of the Spitfires under the wings of the doodlebugs and tipping them over. And it was one of these doodlebugs that had been tipped by a Spitfire. It unfortunately landed on the workshops. And then from the forest, after a month, we stayed in the forest for a month while all this reorganisation was carried on with the REME people. And once they had the workshops back, we were then taken over to the beaches and we landed on the 20th of August. It was the first armoured brigade to land on the beaches, Gold Beach, and without the aid of a wading gear. We landed straight onto the beaches from the landing craft.
What did you see on landing?
It was a bit like being at Southend. The tanks had gone off the boats before the soft vehicles came off, and they'd all disappeared. But we were all the stores, the REME workshops, which were now with us, and everything. We were just sitting on the beaches or on the sand dunes and all those sort of things, but just short of the beaches. And it was to me sitting there in the sun. It was just like being at the seaside and not a sight of aircraft, German aircraft, or anything about. And it was swept through my mind what a sitting target we were if the Germany had an air force to come and bomb us. Because there was an entire brigade of the A echelons sitting there with no air protection at all. And after about 4 days, we were then taken into some various, all the different workshops and stores moved off to different places, but we went into some orchards just outside Bayeux. where we stayed until just before the breakout of the bridgehead, when we had to take yes, we our first battle was for the battle of a place called Caumont, which we had to take, which led actually onto another high ground, which was known on the map reference as Hill 309.
What happened to you in the Battle of Caumont?
Well, see, being the A echelon, again, I was not as a fighting man as such. Only at night we used to go up to the chaps to find out if any spares were wanted and help with the petrol and all that sort of thing.
Were you having any contact with the civilians in Normandy?
No, there was very little civilians about, actually. One thing that you never forget about Normandy is the smell of death, because the cattle had been killed. Also, there was dead Germans and even our own people still laying about. But in particular, the cattle and the Germans, we'd been told in advance that not to touch anything like that because the Germans would booby trap anything like that. So these poor cows and things just laid on the beaches or in the fields. And it was only after the advance out the bridgehead that the people, whoever it was, came along and buried them. But the smell is a smell you never forget. These rotting cattle and German bodies and that sort of thing. And I say from Caumont, there was another high ground, Hill 309, which the number one squadron had the job of holding. I can't really say where the other squadrons were, but we were all in that particular area. The Grenadiers and the Scots, I can't say in what positions they had, but they must have been in there. And the idea being that we was to draw the enemy fire whilst the Americans coming out the Cherbourg Peninsula advanced into France, and also the Guards Armoured Division over on our left went out in front of us, and all the other tanks and infantry. We were just holding fire, or tracking the fire of the Germans while all these people advanced into France. After Hill 309, we went into a place called Via, which was very badly damaged. But because of the Churchill tanks, apparently there was no transporters to keep us up with the front line, which was advancing very rapidly. And a Churchill tank, is very expensive with petrol. It'll only do something like 1 mile to 1 gallon on land, but on a tarmac road it'll do 2 miles to a gallon. This was one of the things that held us back. And the longer we stayed, the distance increased between us. So what they did, I think, was put back into reserve again. Also, the long line of supplies in general for the advance in front, done by the Royal Army Service Corps, they were now stretched. So because our stores lorries, including my own stores, the quartermaster's stores and anybody else's stores, all these were unloaded into the orchard where we were, and the drivers of the trucks were taken away and they joined the RSC temporarily to run stores from the beachhead up to the front line every night. I think it was about 10 days before I saw my driver and my truck back. This, because by the time everything was done, the trucks were back. The troops had advanced through France and into Belgium, and we were now waiting on the Belgium.